Welcome to this week's Rocks Back Pages podcast. My name is Barney Hoskins. I'm here with my colleague, Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
Hi. It was slightly jollier last week.
I know.
Yeah. Should we try it again?
No.
I tried. We will be discussing everything that's new on Rocks Back Pages this week, including an audio interview with the late Hal David. But first, it gives us both enormous pleasure to welcome not just the week's featured writer, Lloyd Bradley, author of such seminal books as Bass Culture and Sounds Like London, but his good friend, Tom Vickers, a legendary figure in the history of Parliament, Funkadelic, and all things George Clinton-esque. Welcome, both of you.
Hi, thank you.
Great to have you here. No better place to start than with, how did you guys, you've known each other for an awfully long time. 40 years. It's a transatlantic, funkadelic friendship that has lasted four decades. So who's going to start with the story of how you met?
Why don't I start
just a little bit, and then
I'll turn it over to Lloyd, because it's pretty interesting. I had come over to the UK with Bootsy's Rubber Band in the summer of 1978, and it's when I met Vivian Goldman, a number of other writers around the town, and did a lot of press, and noticed that there was a real interest in funk in the UK. And a little over a year, maybe 14 months later, George Clinton, Parliament Funkadelic were scheduled to come to the UK. And I was brought aboard to become the Minister of Information to
this great title you were given.
Yes,
did you give that title to yourself?
I think I did, as I recall.
Well, maybe Lloyd gave it to you.
He might have. But I came over here. We did a number of dates in Germany and Holland and other parts of Europe. And then we did five nights at Hammersmith. And this is when the spaceship and the whole deal was happening. So it was sort of a big deal. And I had George in town about, I'm going to say, 3 or 4 days before the first Hammersmith show. And we did a lot of press all over London. All the big, you know, Melody Maker, sure. NME, all that. And then
Cliff White interviewed George, I think.
Cliff, one of the greats.
Yeah.
I applaud him and miss him. So one day we're going to a magazine called Blues and Soul Magazine.
Sure.
And we drive up in the limo and we're getting, you know, to the spot. And all of a sudden, these two fellas come out of the blue like, oh, wow, hey, you guys are here. Wow. And I'm thinking these are staffers from Blues and Soul. Well, this is where I'm going to let Lloyd take over.
Very nicely set up.
Right. Well, Blues and Soul was above a bar called Bradley's Bar, coincidentally, in Hamway Street, which is a tiny
Come on,
street.
You owned it, admit it.
Cool Tempo Records.
Contempo Records was owned by Contempo. John Abbey of Blues and Soul. So the magazine offices were above it. Well, I didn't really know that. I'd been shopping in the record shop regularly. I knew that this tiny street, that this ridiculous metallic gold Bentley that I think Tom probably hired for, to move George around in town, you know, that had trouble negotiating Hamley Street. It was so small, right, you know. And it pulled up, and Tom, Graham Betts, who was the press officer for Pye Records, because Pye had Casablanca in this country, so Pye was looking after George's Parliament. So, and they got out, and then George got out. Now, what it was my mate, Chris, who, as he passed a few years ago, unfortunately, but he was a printer. And back then, there was sort of, there weren't even real big photocopying machines. Mm-hmm. And record companies, or companies in general, record companies as well, used to subcontract their printing, would get it done outside. And he did a lot of printing. His firm did a lot of printing for the record industry. And he knew that this visit was on the cards, that George Clinton was going to Blues and Soul to review the singles. That was the deal. Every issue, a famous musician reviewed the singles. Essentially, they sat in a horrible room upstairs from Contempo, listened to a load of singles and passed judgment on them while someone jotted it down. So he said, oh, it's going to this on this date. And I said, great, right. We're both bunk off work and we'll hang about outside and see if we can meet him. So we did. You know, we hung about outside. And as Tom said, you know, the car pulled up, they got out, and we just sort of came out. I think we'd just been leaning on the wall or something. It was very funny because then one of the guys from Blues and Soul came down to welcome the party. They thought we were with George and Tom. Tom thought we were with Blues and Soul. So come on, let's get up and get started. So me and Chris followed. Went up, and I don't know, I think Tom and Graham were sorting something else out. They ushered me, George Clinton and Chris into this room to review the singles. We had a great afternoon. You know, I can barely believe it. You know, I've got a pile of Funkadelic albums, half a dozen Parliament albums, went to see Bootsy the year before, mm-hmm. You know. And suddenly, I've taken the day off work, and I'm sitting in a room in Hanway Street above a bar called Bradley's Bar, reviewing the singles with George Clinton. Yeah, come make it up, you know. And then we all went downstairs, finished, great time. All went downstairs, you know. The car appeared again. Tom, Graham and George got into it. We said our goodbyes. Bloke from Blues and Soul, Bob Kilbourne, I think it was. Said his goodbyes. Door shut, drove up. And then he looked at me and Chris and said, aren't you going with them? And we said, no. He said, well, didn't you arrive with them? We said, no. We were just waiting outside and we met them. Now, the funny thing was, and this is why I've stayed friends with Tom all these 40 years, because I'm pretty certain he knew something rum was afoot, right? But he never, never grassed us up, you know. He didn't spoil it, right? Good, you know? Man. So they left, and Bob, for Blues and Soul, he said, oh, come upstairs, you know. And he introduced us, the production editor there was a bloke called Jeff, who seemed to sort of run things. Can't remember his surname. He was saying, these guys, they weren't actually with them. And Jeff was really kind of impressed that, God, you just blagged your way into nobody knew, you know. And we talked to Tom and George about seeing them after a show or something. Oh, yeah, we'd love to meet you guys after a show. I think George was kind of actually very pleased to meet some kind of normal black Londoners.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
This was just to hang out with us, you know. So we said, oh, you know, and then Bob said something, yeah, I think he's going to meet them after the show. So, oh, look, if you get anything, like, phone it in for, like, news and mm-hmm. all this.
Yeah.
And we said, yeah, all right. Then Chris didn't actually want to know. He wasn't interested, okay. You know. And then Bob said, do you want to review some albums? And I said, kind of, yeah, all right, why not, you know. And so I took him home and did my best. I mean, I would cringe to read these reviews then.
We may find them.
Yeah, definitely go look for them now.
I'd left school barely literate, so, you know, it was like, doing this was, I just read other ones and thought, oh, this is what I can do, you know, right? And I kind of did all right about them. And then I went up there to give them the albums back, because I didn't realise I could keep them.
Sweet boy.
I was just astonished. No, what you've got is a kid. I was about 20s, very mm-hmm. early 20s. And since I was 15, when I got my first job, at least half of my money went on records mm-hmm. every week. So for someone to give you a record, an album, it's more important than giving you money. You know, they could have given me £3, but to actually give me an album was just astonishing. I had about 5 albums. And I told my mates, I couldn't believe it. What, they gave them to you, you know?
Like this, that free money.
You know, and it never occurred to me to ask to be paid for doing these reviews, because I had albums, you know?
Yeah.
And that was all brilliant, you know? And then we went to a show, and we had tickets for 2 or 3 of the shows at Hammersmith, and one we went to, we didn't have tickets. We just went down there to see if we could bunk in. And somebody was coming out and said, oh, do you want tickets? And we said, yeah, but we don't want to pay for them. And because now there's so many different ways to climb into Hammersmith Odeon, there's no point in buying tickets, right? And
even now?
So this bloke said, no, I don't want any money for them. He goes, my mates let me down, and I don't want to go particularly. You know, he was keener on it. No, he can't go. Do you want them? Well, you're all right. So we went and saw this show, and this one, we were sort of quite down the front, and George recognised us off the stage and was, like, waving, making signs to us. So we met up with him again mm-hmm. at the Savoy, wasn't it?
We were staying at the Savoy, which was pretty mind-blowing.
What was that in about 2 days, basically?
Yeah, and so we went back to Savoy, and we just were in the sort of lobby, you know.
Yeah.
We're talking to George for about 2 hours about all sorts of things. Mm. Just, you know, like life in London and all of this, you know. And
but I have a question, which I've always meant to ask you. I've known you since 1983, I think, or thereabouts, maybe even earlier. Mm. But there's a Sweatband record. I swear, we'll your voice is...
We'll get to this.
Okay, so it is you.
Well, yes, it is you.
Yeah, this is Sweatband record that... Yeah,
my P-Funk name was... Because they didn't have a surname, so Bootsy and them all used to call me London Bridges. Because I was from London, and my name was Lloyd, so we had Lloyd Bridges. It started off as Lloyd Bridges, then it became London Bridges, and then that was just abbreviated to London. Which I was actually quite proud of.
Yeah, that's right.
So like, you're London.
On the Sweatband cover, I'm down as Lloyd London Bridges.
I had a single, you see. Oh, right. And I bought that years ago, and I'm like, that's fucking Lloyd.
Yeah, it is.
I've always meant to ask you, was that you?
Yeah, it is.
Tell us about how you became the Minister of Information for P-Funk.
Well, I've relayed this story many times, and it's on a Mike Judge animated series called Tales from the Tour Bus, which if you can access it either through Amazon Prime or any other means, I urge you all to watch it. It's really entertaining. Basically, I was a white rock critic based in San Francisco for Rolling Stone magazine. And I'd done Journey, Ted Nugent, a lot
of very funky acts.
Jefferson, Starship, you know, all these, like, do I really need to listen to this, let alone write about it? But one day my editor, who was sort of a radical lefty from Chicago, a guy named Abe Peck, called me in and said, you know, you've done all this rock stuff, but do you know much about R&B? And I said, well, yeah, I know a lot about it. And he said, would you be interested in writing about R&B? And I said, more than this junk you're throwing at me. And he said, well, who would you write about if you could write about anyone right now? Who would that be? And I said, the OJs, because they had I Love Music out at the time. So he said, sure, go ahead. So I flew down to L.A., got to see the OJs rehearse with famed Motown choreographer Charlie Atkins, which was a story in and of itself, did the interview with the OJs. The gist of the article was that Gamble and Huff's names were on the OJs album about a dozen times. Not once were all three individual OJs' names given in the album. Mm-hmm. So who are these guys, basically? So I write this article. And it caused some uproar at Philly International. And then Gamble and Huff said, well, we want an article written about us.
What a surprise.
Okay, why not? You know? Yeah. So I flew to Philadelphia, interviewed Gamble and Huff, hung out with Bunny Sigler, famed Philly soul man, went to an MFSB taping, had a lot of incredible experiences there, came back, wrote the article. Then, you know, Teddy Pendergrass, Johnny Guitar Watson, two or three others came along. And at that stage, and Lloyd will remember this, once you became a certified journalist, you would get boxes of albums delivered to your front door every day in flats. And every day I'd open them up and I'd go through them, like, oh, this is rubbish. I don't really care about this. And I have one pile that would go back to the used record store and another pile that I would listen to. So I'm opening. One comes up with a guy coming out of a spaceship. And I go, wow, this looks pretty amazing.
Let me put this
in the to be listened to pile. Then another comes up with sort of this ghetto art, Tales of Kid Funkadelic, or, you know, so let's take it to the stage. I can't remember which one. Mm. And I put them, as fate would have it, right on top of each other. So 10 minutes later, I'm going through and listening to each one of these. And I'm looking at all the album art, and I'm, wait a minute. They're the same guys in both of these bands. How can this be? They're signed to two different labels. How does this work, you know? So I went down to the local used record store and bought every Parliament and Funkadelic record I could find, came home and immersed myself into the world of George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic for the next week and listened to everything and heard the evolution and sort of the de-evolution of P-Funk, if you will. Mm. And then went into my editor and said, hey, can I write about these guys? And he said, sure, go ahead, you know. Yeah. So I was supposed to go out on the road with them for 3 days. 3 days turned into a week. And I got to hang out with Bootsy and George, and this was pre-Mothership. Mm-hmm. They were selling out 5,000-6,000 seat arenas. So article ran, and I had a clever idea to put what we call the P-Funk and Wagnalls in there, because I've always been a fan of slang, and George had a slanguage all of his own. And so I added that aspect to it. And lo and behold, the article became a big success. You know, people really took notice. So 3 weeks later, sitting in my flat in San Francisco, phone rings. Hello? Hey, man, it's George. George, how you doing, man? What's up? Oh, everything's good, man. I can't thank you enough for that article. And I said, well, hey, that's what I do. You know, it's what I'm paid to do. I'm glad I could do it. I had a blast with you guys. He says, well, the party ain't over. And I said, what do you mean? He says, I want you to come and work for me. I go, what? I said, George, I'm a white guy up here in San Francisco. He says, you could be a purple guy from Mars. You know what the funk's about, and you got to help me spread the word. And I said, well, what's going on? He said, well, I'm going out on tour with a spaceship, and I need somebody to kind of get the hip rock white press to pay attention to what we're doing. And would you be interested? And I said, well, when and how and what would you pay me and how would this all work? He said, I'll move you down to L.A., pay you $1,000 a month, which in 1976 would be comparable to about $5,000 a month now. And if you want to do it, we'd love to have you come on board. And I said, I'm in. So I moved to L.A. and dove into this world that was life-changing for me. And, you know, I'm still pinching myself that I was a part of it. Because I went on to do a lot of different things in the music industry. But of all the things I've done, Parliament Funkadelic resonates more with the listening audience, the young fans, than any other aspect of anything I've ever been involved with. And I don't know if it's because of Bruno Mars, Uptown Funk, or George announcing his retirement. But now more than ever, Parliament Funkadelic seems to be back in the spotlight.
I think in a way, they never really quite went away. Certainly in this country, there's been a lot of interest for decades in Parliament Funkadelic. And it comes and goes a bit. But George was coming over here over the last 5 years with the P-Funk All-Stars, selling out big halls. It's never gone away.
Since you talked about the hip rock press, Tom, and that leads me back to my memories of first meeting Lloyd. I had started writing on the NME about, I guess, 81. And I was writing about some funk and soul and R&B, and Danny Baker had written about. And then suddenly I see this byline, Lloyd Bradley, and I'm like, oh, fuck, this guy really knows what he's talking about. Shit. The number's up, you know. And then I guess I would have... what I remember is the Prince Charles and the City Beat Band that you reviewed. It may have been one of the first things that you reviewed for NME.
Thank you. The first thing I did for NME was Cliff White. We mentioned him earlier. Cliff was at the NME, and Cliff was also at this magazine, Black Music.
Yes.
And Jazz Review, or just became Black Music, a monthly, that operated in the same building as Blues and Soul. They were the same company.
They were.
And Cliff wrote for Black Music as well.
Certainly did.
And Neil Spencer was editor of the NME then, and they wanted to put together this two-part over centre spreads for 2 weeks of the NME, of a funk wall chart, a wall chart that explained funk and its progression and origins. Yeah. And they didn't have anybody to do it, to be quite honest. They asked Cliff, and Cliff said, well, I couldn't do this, but there's someone I know from sort of downstairs at Blues and Soul that could. So yeah. Cliff phoned me, got me up, and I sketched it out with the art editor at the time. I had a really great afternoon, actually, sort of pissing about with this guy, art editor, Richard Shushak, I think his name was.
Before my time.
Neil sort of drifted in and out of the conversation. Cliff was there, but didn't really have much to do with it, you know. And, you know, we had a couple of beers out the editor's cocktail cabinet. I thought this was all brilliant, and I just had a great time. And I thought, blimey, and I've contributed to the NME, and they thought I was pretty cool, and I thought that was great. And then he offered me 50 quid. I couldn't believe it. And I said, 50 quid? He said, oh, yeah, for each week. So that's 100. I couldn't believe it. I nearly said, you didn't have to pay me for this. I've had such a laugh.
Yeah. Yeah, not a sentence that's escaped your lips many times then.
And it was just astonishing. So because of that, then he said, oh, go and see the reviews editor, get some albums to review. So fine, I did. And later on, he started asking me, what should they be looking at? That's when Prince Charles and the City Beat Band came in, because I realised fairly quickly that my job at the NME was to identify upcoming young, or not necessarily young, but emerging black talent, and do the first piece on them, and then when they're a hit, hand them over to the white boys.
So you often did like import, and that Prince Charles, I remember, was on import. Yep.
I did a one-page piece on Gil Scott-Heron when nobody had heard of him, and then, you know, became big, so on, you know, that's... That was
your role. Yeah, yeah. That was your job. I mean, did you? Yeah. I mean, was it a strange environment to come into? Did you feel like at home there? I mean, what was it? What was your experience? I certainly felt it got very intimidating. But you're about 6'4". Sorry, I think you've shrunk an inch since I last saw you. Yeah, no, I measured you when you came in.
No, not really. I mean, it was just like a bunch of white boys that were full of themselves, you know, really. I mean, great. I mean, I did what I had to do. Some guys I got on with, some guys I didn't, same as any office you're going to wander into. I did what I had to do, and I didn't even resent the fact that every time, you know, an act I'd bought to the paper crossed over, so to speak, that I then lost them, because, to be quite honest, I didn't think I was good enough at the writing to do the big pieces.
Well, the first piece that we're going to feature on the homepage is neatly dovetailing, but is this great piece you wrote on George Clinton in January 1983.
Yeah, so I've been at the NME for a couple of years by then, so I had a bit more confidence at that point.
But it's a great piece, you know, and I think Computer Games has just come out.
Because it was on Capitol, it was done by Capitol. Yeah.
And you talked to him about the disputes, you know, the Warner Brothers, the Roger Troutman album. And it's an interesting thing he says about, he kind of disses Prince. Yeah. It's really interesting. Take Prince. I like his ideas and arrangements, but he lacks that total emotion behind the concept. So he ends up playing so light and so commercial. Ultimately, it's less enduring.
Do you know, I can't argue with that now.
Another piece you wrote a little bit later, Lloyd, was about none other than Hothouse for Q in 1988. And my good friend Mark, the chief archivist of Roxburgh Pages, that was his band. And I don't know if you remember talking to Hothouse.
I don't even know who Hothouse is.
this is marvellous. This is my old band. We were a blink and you missed it. English R&B band. Address you in tones of your crystal glass. People accuse me of a lack of tact. Heather Small went on to Ben People.
Yeah, I know who she is.
Yeah, and you interview. I have no memory of this interview. But it's definitely
nor does he.
But it's definitely me, because I use certain terms like
I'm a bit long in the tooth to change now. I'm at the age of 32.
That's me, you know. So it's just hilarious. No, I'm absolutely. I can absolutely completely understand why you have absolutely no memory of this whatsoever. It's for Q.
Neither of you has any memory of this. No. You may have spoken on the phone. Perhaps we just made this piece up and attributed it to Lloyd.
I wouldn't surprise me. the whole thing really is that with Q, because it was a monthly, it was that new format, you actually did more work during the month. There was more pages to fill, I think, features-wise. And so there was loads of these things where you'd just be thinking, do you want to do this? Oh, it's happening now, you know. Oh, we need it by tomorrow afternoon. And it's, you know, it's only it's a page up front, you know. And you're right. So the spirit of Q was such that you didn't say no to anything because I really enjoyed, like, that magazine, what it was, the people that were there, and their kind of excitement.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, people like Andy Gill.
God rest his soul.
Andy, Paul DeNoyer, Andy Cowles, Mark Allen, you know, it was all John Baldy. It was all really exciting, you know. So there was nothing you said no to for Q, even if you thought you perhaps weren't brilliantly qualified to do it or, you know, whatever. You say, yeah, I'll do it. If you think I'd do it, I'll do it. And so you'd end up doing these things, turning them over really quickly.
Yeah,
so, of course, you kind of forget about them. I've probably forgotten a lot more than remember.
I have no memory of this one to you whatsoever. I can remember
You were a rock star then, so you were
We were a desperate failure, to be honest about it.
You'd just been on tour with Barry White at
just supported Barry White around England. Which was a fairly kind of ghastly experience. I'll actually briefly talk about him later, but his wife, Glodine, and his daughter were backing singers, and he wouldn't have them on stage with him. They were either behind panels to one side by the monitor mixing desk, or at the Albert Hall, they were in a backstage corridor, but dressed to the nines.
Yeah, with long nails.
Glodine, right? You'd have to insert your hand to shake her hand out, considering it's lacerated by her nails. And I learnt subsequently that actually they were on the way to a divorce, that their marriage was falling to pieces. He would go back to the Dorchester every night, regardless of where we were playing in England, or in one case, Scotland. And they would stay in the same hotel as the road crew.
He'd go back to the Dorchester from Scotland and then go to back up to Sheffield.
That's
daft, isn't it?
At the Manchester Apollo, he was standing with the Manchester Apollo is a big old-fashioned brick-built cinema. So when you're in a basement, the walls are really thick. It's just the nature of the way brick-built buildings are built. And we were in our dressing room, and he was outside talking to someone, and the plastic cups were vibrating on the counter in our dressing room because his voice was so low, it travelled through the wall.
Tom, so Mark and I were talking this morning, saying, you know, reminding ourselves that we've wanted to have you on Rock's Back Pages for donkey's years. We even have your pieces, like, indexed, don't we? You did stuff for that kind of soul R&B supplement that Phonograph Record did. Quite a few copies of that in the other room. And obviously we're not going to let you go today without signing over your everything. So we're glad you're here for that reason. But you've had a long and very distinguished career in the music industry. I mean, you essentially, I know you've always written and you still keep your hand in there, but essentially you've done a lot of A&R gigs. Billy Gibbons is someone you've collaborated with. You were telling me a great story about Billy before we started recording.
Right. I'm meeting him at a P-Funk gig.
Billy Gibbons at a P-Funk gig.
Pine Bluff, Arkansas, or some buttfuck Oklahoma. I mean, God knows where it was. And usually I'd walk through the crowd and it would all be, you know, hardcore African-American P-Funk fans. I see these guys with beards and I go, what the hell? What are you guys doing here? And then I look at it, wait a minute, you're the guys in ZZ Top. Yeah, hey, Billy Gibbons, Dusty Hill. Hey, nice to meet you. Who are you? Well, I work with P-Funk. You want to meet him? Yeah, sure. So I bring him back to meet George and everybody.
Fantastic.
And it's a love fest. And Billy says, hey, give me your card. So I give him my card, and I figure I'm never going to hear from this guy. 2 weeks later, phone rings. Hey, Tom, Billy, hey, man, I'm going to be in town. Let's hang out. So we've had almost as long as Lloyd and I, like a 40-year friendship. And as I was saying earlier before the interview started, I did do a lot of different things with a lot of different artists. And I worked with, you know, when I was at A&M, Brothers Johnson, LTD, Jeffrey Osborne.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When I was at Capitol, I A&R'd a Peebo Bryson album. worked with a number of Vanessa Williams, Brian McKnight when I was with Mercury. But I've always had a fondness for R&B and soul and funk, and I've always had a sort of simpatico vibe with the musicians that create this music. Mm. And to Lloyd's point earlier, there was sort of an apartheid, a cultural apartheid going about the white rock press, whether it was over here or in the U.S. Like with MTV, in the early days of MTV, there were the two or three chosen sort of crossovery type acts that Rolling Stone would anoint with holy water. You know, Ike and Tina Turner, Jimi Hendrix, or whatever.
I'd say in this country, certainly the NME always exhibited a passion for black music.
Right.
Going right back to the sort of the early 70s. I see Lloyd kind of creasing his face on, but compared to the American press, the NME really lavishly covered.
And Cliff was writing as early as sort of 75, 76, and, you know, knowledgeably and passionately.
But to your point, Cliff White, I love him to death. A white guy, John Abbey, a white guy.
Sure.
Me, a white guy.
I mean, one thing about the American music press is, let's say a magazine like Hullabaloo, I mean, we got quite a collection of stuff. You see Hullabaloo in like 68, 69, writing about black music quite extensively. By 1974, it's turned to a circus, and you do not see a black face in the room at all. And it's partly a consequence of FM radio, the way FM radio developed into a really much more segmented thing than AM radio was. AM radio, like English pop radio in the 60s, you could hear the Supremes followed by Gene Pitney, followed by whatever. And suddenly when you can get a lot of individual stations which are playlist dominated, that you get this real sort of apartheid appearing there.
Yeah.
And that reflects itself in the press.
I mean, Lloyd, I know you're at work on a book called Funk Is Its Own Reward, aren't you?
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
How long do we have to wait for that? And tell us a little bit about that.
That should be August next year.
Okay.
And what is, I'm taking the same approach as I took with Bass Culture and Sounds Like London.
Yes.
And I'm reconnecting the music with the culture that created it, because that's what you were talking about just now. When mainstream press and many, many, many authors have written about black music, it's essentially been a list of records. And seldom, as it going back and connecting with the culture that created it, there's a lot of what, but there's never any why. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the reasons why the relationship between, say, black music, soul and reggae, and the mainstream press and media is so flimsy, because that isn't there. It's seen as purely as entertainment. Here's a record, entertain me. Mm-hmm. You know, how did you make that record, you know? Which is one of the reasons why, if you look at the current situation, you look at grime, dubstep, that is being marketed and created by the people it's for. You know, they have never, that's never lost
a connection. Yeah.
You know, because they're in charge of it.
Yes.
You know, and why it's all over the charts as well, because what you end up with then is a genuine expression. Mm. And I honestly believe, and to tell you the truth, the sales of Bass Culture and Sounds Like London bear this out. I mean, Bass Culture is still selling 2,000 copies a year, 20 years later.
Yeah.
You know, I can't remember what printing Sounds Like London's in now. Mm. But what it is, I've always said that the mainstream public, give them a bit more credit, actually. They're a bit more robust than the guardians of our culture think they are.
That
actually, most white people want to hear the real story of what this was about, you know, and they can handle it. You know?
I mean, it's very interesting about grime, is because, I mean, it's not for me. It's absolutely not for me. But it's about and sounds like a London I recognise in a way that I can't say that about any other music, you know.
Well, I've got to interrupt you, because when I wrote Sounds Like London, I realised that what it was for me and my experience, I understand grime is London in the 21st century, but for me, London in the 70s and 80s, say, was soul to soul, was London.
Yeah, sure.
Totally London.
Sure.
Yes.
That sound and Jazzy B couldn't have happened anywhere other than London.
Yeah.
And because Jazzy was essentially in total charge of what he did, he presented the London that all kids, black, white, Indian, whatever, saw. and heard. Mm-hmm. And they reacted to it immediately. Yeah. You know, it wasn't a couple of 50-year-old Oxbridge types in an A&R department saying, oh, no, I don't think that's what the kids want. Mm.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, was, completely.
This was actually it. And grime, dubstep, and all of those, I mean, the style's evolved so fast. Mm-hmm. There's probably been a new one since I came in here. But what it is it's unfiltered. It reflects them completely. Mm-hmm. It's sound system culture. Yeah. It's this is what our audience wants, so this is what we're going to do.
Yes, yes.
With the additional advantages that means of production are at hand in the way that they never were before.
Yeah. Oh, completely. Yeah. I mean, also, I really believe, you know, and this is probably straying off our original point, but if people like Dennis Bavell and, you know, Lloydie Coxon and the greats of London sound systems had had the internet and digital technology, they'd rule the world by now. Mm. I'm sure of it. Because they were so smart and so entrepreneurial and so
in such difficult circumstances.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, the third piece that I chose to feature you on the homepage, like, is a piece about Jazzy B, essentially about Soul to Soul, looking back with Jazzy B on those great years and the sound system background that they came out of. So it's very apposite that you mentioned that, and I know it sounds like London is, you know, the sort of definitive book on this sound.
I love that book. I thought it was really fabulous.
I mean, interesting. I mean, I think we should bring Tom in here because, you know, you could get me back next week. But what sound system culture was like was the same as the black radio in America. You know, when that boomed in the 1970s, early 1970s, it ripped the lid off black music suddenly, you know.
It did. I mean, when Frankie Crocker had the number one rated BLS station in New York, and he was the number one rated DJ. Mm-hmm. That shone a light on this in such a way that it benefited George specifically because, you know, what had become an underground or what had been looked at as an underground phenomenon was now not only getting mainstream radio play, but selling in million lots of records and creating a cultural impact above and beyond what anybody anticipated. Mm. And it helped George a lot in that George never wanted to cross over to pop radio. That wasn't his goal. Mm-hmm. His goal was to cross over to AOR rock radio. Now, the fact that black radio became so important and such a heavy thing, all the major labels figured, we got to get a piece of this P-Funk thing, which was both a blessing and a curse. It was a blessing in that Bernie Worrell, the Horny Horns, Brides of Funkenstein, Eddie Hazel, all these offshoots of George's P-Funk empire all got record deals. But the downside was it stretched George way too thin, way, way, way too thin. Mm-hmm. And between being in the studio, every time he wasn't on the road, he was in either Hollywood or Detroit recording. It just got to the point where between the drugs, the touring, the studio, he was, I think, physically and sort of mentally exhausted.
Yeah, he was hanging out with Sly Stone as well, which is pretty
That's not good for anyone's health. Tom, staying stateside, it leads us actually quite neatly into a discussion of the week's audio. As you may or may not know, we feature a new audio interview every week, and this is an interview with Hal David of Bacharach and David fame. Next week, Burt Bacharach, 90 years old, will be performing just literally about a quarter of a mile away at the Eventim Apollo, the old Hammersmith. He's doing a week of shows there at 90, which is amazing. But everything we've talked about just sort of makes me think of that very interesting time in New York where you had the Brill Building, you had those sort of songwriting factories. And the story that Hal talks about, a lot about in this audio, is very much about this musical romance between Burt and Hal and Dionne Warwick. I was just going to quickly ask you about your sort of memories of particularly Bacharach and David's version of soul, if you want to call it soul, I don't know, just extraordinary pop music.
Right.
Do you remember listening to those records?
I actually saw Dionne Warwick in a nightclub that subsequently burned down in an Italian lightning storm.
That's a great phrase.
Where all of a sudden this famed nightclub just went up in smoke. Right. But I did see Dionne Warwick in this period. I did read Bert's autobiography recently. Though we didn't perceive it per se as quote-unquote soul music because it was so refined and so orchestrated. But reading Bert's autobiography, I realized all the great records he made pre-Hal David. And then when Hal came into the mix and they had their run with Dionne, it was just over the moon. But again, that, when I was talking about George wanting to cross over to rock radio, Hal and Bert were crossing over to pop radio with very refined records and artists that, as Motown was doing the same sort of thing, this had less of the soul component, maybe because you didn't have the Funk Brothers and the studio musicians.
And it was very much balanced as well. It wasn't like dance music. This was, you know.
But some of the greatest, I would say, Black American voices that we've ever heard. You know, I mean, even people like Lou Johnson,
Luther Vandross's cover of
Vandross later, obviously, doing A House Is Not a Home. Yeah. But Mark, why don't we listen to a clip from that?
Well, let's listen to actually precisely about this. It's about, they'd written Make It Easy on Yourself. Dionne had demoed it. We forget that Dionne started off as their demo singer.
Right.
And anyway, it becomes a huge hit for Jerry Butler. So let's listen to that clip.
And then one day, we wrote a song called Make It Easy on Yourself. And we got Dionne in to make the record, make the demo. And we made the demo. It was quite wonderful. And we were, Bert was still a period we were with Famous Music. And we played it for the publisher, Eddie Walton, the head of Famous at the time. And he liked it. And he took it to, I'm trying to think of, we made the first big record. But anyway, Dionne got very upset when the record came out. It became a big hit. And she said, "I thought that was my song." We said, "No, well, you just made the demo."
Oh, no.
She said, "No, that was my song." And she was really very hurt and angry.
Yeah.
And then we realized, you know, here's this wonderful singer, and we're using it to make demos. I mean, she could be a star. And we took those demos to Scepter Records, a woman named Florence Greenberg, who ran Scepter Records. And we got her a contract. And then we went in and started to record it. The first one was Don't Make Me Over.
Don't make me over. Now that I do anything for you. Don't make me over.
So something that's really interesting is that, I mean, he talks in this interview about how, in a way, the two of them and Dionne Warwick were a trio. I mean, he actually describes them as that. He also talks later on in the interview about how they fell out around a time when Bert started making his own records and Dionne was fed up. Where's my songs? You know, because Bert was writing just for himself. And in fact, he said they've all made it up, all kissed and made up, they're all friends. But, and he talks about the, we'll play a clip later about being in the Brill Building, this tiny cubicle with a piano and a desk, writing the songs with Bert Bacharach. Talks about his favourite songwriters he admires, Johnny Mercer in particular, a big one that he loved. Not feeling threatened by the Beatles and Dylan and so on, self, because in a sense they were continuing to have hits while that was going on, so it wasn't in the same way as a lot of American acts were really threatened by that. Having Paul Simon being one of his demo singers back in the Brill Building before Paul Simon became Simon Garfunkel. And his pleasure in the revival of interest in their work in the present day. He's delightful. He comes over as a really...
He's really charming, isn't he? I mean, it's great to him. And even though we've all heard stories of the Brill Building, it's great to hear someone like Hal David actually describing what it was like to work in these tiny little rooms.
You couldn't open the window because the air conditioner was in and on all year round, you know. Yeah.
He talks beautifully as well about the bittersweet quality of the great Bacharach and David songs. They're simultaneously jaunty and sad, and which I think is a great word. Yeah. There is a jauntiness often, but the melodies are so... Tom, I know you're itching to say something about Burt.
What I wanted to say wasn't specifically about Burt Bacharach or Hal David, but about music publishing and how, again, that's sort of the blessing and curse of the music industry. All of the British acts who, Beatles, Stones, etc., who went either over the U.S. or had people like Phil Spector or Gene Pitney with the Stones come over here, learned quickly that, you can make a lot of money in this business, but the long-term real money is in music publishing. Mm. And music publishing is, been downplayed by, it's coupon clippers. Oh, you're only making, pennies. Why bother with that? But if you wrote a hit song, it's still making you money. Yeah. I mean, and this is creating...
Even if you don't write a hit, but it gets played on the radio for some reason. I mean, I went my old band Hot House, we had one song, a single week, Radio 1 for 2 weeks. Shame you couldn't actually buy the record because the record company couldn't get it in the store. But it was played like 4 or 5 times a day. And I got a check for like £4,000 just for like 2 weeks of,
And it's caused more bands, artists, situations to implode than any other.
Who's got the publishing?
Who's got the publishing? Yeah. And the most important thing to tie it back into George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic, George and the original Parliament drove from Plainfield, New Jersey to Detroit to try out for Motown. And, Motown had the Temptation, Smokey and the Miracles, mm-hmm. the Four Tops, blah, blah, blah. Here come these sort of odd-looking characters. One's, 5'2", the other's 6'4", they don't really look the part, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. And after the rehearsal, Berry Gordy looked at him and said, now we've got the Temptation, we got mm-hmm. the Tops, but who wrote all these songs? And George I did. And he said, I want to give you a publishing deal. So George was signed to a publishing deal at Jobet very early on. And not only did that give him a lot of knowledge about songs and songwriting, but also about music publishing, mm-hmm. which then created further issues down the road. When Funkadelic started to hit and then Parliament started to hit and people didn't feel they were getting their fair share of what they were entitled for.
There was also a lot of people. I mean, wasn't that also a problem? The between the two bands and the whole organization and all the sub-bands, that George had a lot of people in his payroll.
Yeah.
And people started seeing some people getting more than others. And
well, let's just take their biggest hit, Give Up the Funk, mm-hmm. Tear the Roof Up. The drummer, Jerome Braley, came up with all those amazing drum breaks mm-hmm. and stops and hitting it hard on the one. And really adding a dimension to that track that is undeniable. Mm-hmm. So George gave him a piece of the publishing mm-hmm. on that song. And 6 months later, he gets his first publishing check. That was it. He was done. Hey, see you guys. Bye. He quit the band and formed his own band called Mutiny and had an album called Mutiny on the Mothership. And all of a sudden, other members of the band, the light bulb started going off over other people's heads. Like, wait a minute. Mm. How come Jerome left? Well, didn't you hear he just got a check for $150,000?
Yeah.
Really? What? How come?
Yeah.
Well, he co-wrote Tear the Roof Off. Mm. Well, I had a piece of such and such, and George never gave me credit mm-hmm. for that. And
yeah.
And I've seen music publishing and credits break up more bands and mess up more situations.
Mm-hmm. I think we're probably kind of coming to, we're going to have to move over to the to what is new,
what's new
for subscribers in the library this week. Feel free to sort of chip in.
Absolutely.
But this is like, these are some of the more interesting pieces that are going into the library.
I mean, it's a fairly short list this week. Fats Domino being interviewed by David Griffiths, the Record Mirror in 67. Very first time Fats Domino had come over. A lot of other American rock and rollers and R&B artists been over in the late 50s and early 60s. First time Fats done it. And he's loving it, you know. But he was asked about, you know, you've done well, you've got this big house in New Orleans. And he says, I spend an awful lot of money, you know. That home costs $15,000 a month just to run. And I got 8 children. They use up a lot, you know. It's a very sweet, very short, short interview. Jimmy Page interviewed by Chris Welch, Melody Maker 70. I mean, it's the usual Jimmy Page flannel, you know, with Welch being kind of rather too accommodating. But he says, Robert is a Leo, which makes him a perfect leader, with 2 Capricorns on either side and a Gemini behind. Brian Case, a profile, a kind of retrospective on Albert Eiler, Enemy 74. Brian Case is a writer I really, really loved when I started reading The Enemy. And he's talking about Milford Graves, who's a really great jazz drummer. Love Cry has the simple counterpoint of the horns, underpinned by the spectacular Milford Graves. Gunslinger fast, Graves works his drum kit from all points of the compass, never still. Snick, click, sneeze, bang, gong, like a claim jumper panning a riverbed. And then as Isla did a kind of obligatory sort of jazz funk record, which by all accounts is pretty terrible. And Brian Case lays into Bernard Pretty Purdy. As an innocent primitive form for the Isla energy, rock is corsets, too rhythmically static. The electric bass comes on like sinus trouble. And if Pretty Purdy's drumming has a backbeat, you can't lose it. He's also got a pair of ears, you can't find them.
Ooh, savage.
Philip Norman, Barry White. Reviewing Barry White at the Albert Hall in, for the Times in 1975. There remains something unearthly in the success enjoyed by Barry White. He's a black singer, extremely overweight, whose songs invariably express agitation at the prospect of imminent sexual intercourse. Later on says, I myself received a very good view of Barry White since immediately he appeared, he left the stage and advanced up the aisle towards me with the palpable intention of shaking my hand. The effect at close quarters of such a stout, velvety man holding in one hand a microphone, a lighted cigarette and several jewelled rings was, to say the least, intimidating. In the event, however, he changed his mind and shook the hand of the person behind me.
Feels so good. You're lying here next to me.
Paul Gamble, brief interview with Mick Jagger. Mick Jagger is at this point sort of proposing he was going to go to university to study history. This is in 1976. It's kind of limiting in a way, using your intellect to write songs like Brown Sugar. Keith Moon, obviously Simon Frith had been commissioned to write a review of, which album would that have been, 1978?
Who are you?
And anyway, Keith Moon dies, so it turns into a semi-obituary for Keith. The Who is dead now, too. Whatever the remaining 3 do, they won't be The Who again. Even in technical terms, no drummer will ever be able to recreate Keith Moon's extraordinary controlled anarchy, his stuttering hands and solid feet. And I think there's a lot of truth in that.
Absolutely.
Barbara Ellen meets Kellis Matthews of Catatonia in 98. She says, looks-wise, Matthews was born in the wrong era. Her face belongs to one of those fallen girls from worthy 60s films who end up pushing a pram around cobbled streets, looking tough and beautiful in slingbacks and a cross-wrap apron. And it's actually quite good.
That sounds about right.
And lastly, again, it's Barbara Ellen reviewing Eminem at London Astoria in 1999. I wish Eminem had been even half as good at your story as on record. As it is, he's so sloppy, so disengaged, that I can hardly make out which songs he's playing.
Hi, my name is...
There's a DJ behind him who couldn't scratch his way out of a tray of cat litter. Another sidekick is plodding about dressed as a magic mushroom, but it really isn't funny. Eminem just stands there, rummaging about in his sweatsuit pants and ranting yobbishly. After the crowd boo him, he trudges back on stage, indignant, and bellows his way through his biggest hit, Guilty Conscience. I saw him in the following year at the London Docklands Arena, and it was terrible. And the question is, how often and how can hip-hop be a good show in a large room? Any Lloyd, thoughts? Do you have any sort of thoughts? Have you seen many hip-hop shows which have lit you up as live shows?
Early hip-hop shows. I've not seen too many. I mean, not seen too many later hip-hop shows. I mean, Run DMC were always spectacular to watch in whatever size. I mean, I think if you work to tailor your show to an arena size, which Run DMC clearly did, you know, then, I saw the Beastie Boys as well. I mean, I'm going back to the kind of Def Jam era.
Yeah, sure.
Quite clearly, Rick Rubin or somebody was teaching them how to do this, you know, because I remember at the Philadelphia Spectrum seeing the Beastie Boys with Public Enemy open
for
them. That was a great show.
Yeah.
Public Enemy put on a great show as well. Yeah. But again, we're talking about all the same era, you know, and essentially the same people. You know, Houdini put on a great show as well. But that was more like a very slick R&B show, you know.
I saw a very late period LL Cool J depping for a missing Lauryn Hill's free concert in Chicago in Grant Park. And he was astonishingly good. And I was expecting absolutely nothing, but this guy had an absolute command of the audience, the dynamics, and a really great DJ behind him, really cutting up the records, you know.
But then again, he's from that
era.
That stable, you know, he was a Def Jam artist. Yeah. So, I mean, I saw LL Cool J at Hammersmith Odeon, and I think it was Houdini opened for him, and it was really good. Yeah, and big arenas, they could command a big arena.
Because Eminem, it's basically people stomping around the stage just shouting. There was no sort of, there was a lot of stage set, a lot of presentation, but there was no sort of sense of engagement with the audience. It just sounded like sort of unfiltered anger just being belted through a microphone.
Wasn't that his USP?
Well, I suppose it was, but anger doesn't make for a great live show.
Probably not.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was interesting reading her actually more of seeing exactly the same thing a year before I saw pretty much
that
exactly
is interesting. I saw Snoop live once, and this was very, very early on in the Snoop canon.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this would have been Doggy Style time. And his show was distinctly underwhelming. I mean, it really did quite surprise me.
Which is a shame, because
how bad it was, because the album was so good.
Yeah,
isn't it?
And he's a very musical rapper. Yeah, I mean, the way in which he uses his voice is actually very beautiful and should be able to translate. It's true. So, I mean, you know, your point is that the early guys developed a sort of sense of how to present themselves.
Seem to.
And that's been lost somewhere in the process.
Well, from my perspective, what happened was you have to realize that black artists playing in large arenas worked to Rick James, P-Funk, Stevie.
Prince,
blah, blah, blah. When rap came in the initial stages, like what Lloyd's talking about, there was a certain joy element to it and a certain empowerment, Public Enemy, things like that. When it became sort of angry and pissed off, that became scary to not the powers that be, but to the general audience. They didn't want it necessarily, like the Beastie Boys acting stupid or Run DMC, My Adidas, or what's his name, Kool Moe Dee, or any of these guys. It was funny. It was joyous. It had a sense of life to it.
Yeah.
When it came later into sort of braggadocio about, you know, how many people you shot or how many, you know, it's like, I don't know if I want to know that much about this, you know? And all of a sudden, the large arenas wouldn't allow a Public Enemy in, you know? The Beastie Boys always could get in because they were white. But there was a certain fear factor, and that hasn't dissipated. I mean, there are very few big, I'm going to say, arena-style hip-hop shows going on anymore, over here.
Interesting thing. You know my son, George.
Yeah.
George, about 3 months ago, I think, went to see 50 Cent at the O2. And this is clearly, he said it was fantastic. He said he came because he's a 50 Cent fan from back in the day, and this was a sort of 20th anniversary, 30th anniversary tour. And the way he described it is quite clear, because you know 50's making a fortune out of his film company and all of this at the moment. Yeah, TV. He's got a piece of that TV series Power and this sort of stuff, right. You know, and he's pumping out kind of pulp fiction films, mm-hmm. You know, and it was almost as if he'd done this to celebrate who he was and who put him there, because from how George described the show to me, it seemed highly unlikely, you know, that he was ever going to make any money.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he was really personable, clearly enjoying himself, just wanted to be there,
mm-hmm.
to recreate his old self and have a bit of fun.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And George said it was probably the best show he's ever seen.
That's great. You
know? Wow.
That's good. Great. Well,
gentlemen, I think we are very close to being out of time. I just want to say on behalf of both of us and all of us here at RBP, just what a great pleasure it's been to have you both reminiscing and sharing your thoughts with us. Tommy, you're visiting, obviously. I think you're over here mainly for Wimbledon, well, is that correct?
It's have
a very, very sort of hip-hop kind of thing to do.
I love the UK. I grew up outside of Boston, and when all the big English acts would come over to the States, the first place they would play is Boston. So I saw the Beatles, I saw the Stones with Brian Jones, Cream, Jeff Beck with Rod Stewart, all the big Brit acts.
Yeah.
So I've always had sort of a love affair with the UK. And everybody said, hey, have you been to England? Well, yeah. Where'd you go? Well, I went to London. Well, yeah, that's great. You know, from having British friends like Lloyd and a few others, I've learned about all the myriad of beautiful places that are sort of under the radar to most Americans. So I've been to the Cotswolds, the Lake District, Devon, Cornwall, the Borders, places that most Americans don't go. Mm. And in so doing, my appreciation for your country has gotten bigger. I love tennis. I've been playing since I was 12 years old. I have an inn at Wimbledon, which has allowed me to go, which is, if you're an American, just to get a ticket is a very difficult and sometimes costly affair. So for me to be able to go to Wimbledon has been Valhalla. I call it the Sistine Chapel of tennis.
That's great.
So it's been great.
Tom, while you're here, maybe you can help to find a new ambassador that might just, you know, meet Donald Trump's approval. So, we got a couple more days.
I think it's way too heavy lifting and way above my pay grade to come up with that, you know?
Well, listen, welcome back to England and to London. Lloyd, thank you so much for allowing me to bully you into coming here today.
You won't do it.
I hope you thought it was worth it, because it's been really a joy to just, to see your friendship and to hear your stories. And I hope you'll come back again sometime. And we are going to play out, Mark, with another clip from the late, great Hal Day. This is 1999, talking to Adam Sweetie.
Yeah, this is him talking about their room in the Brill Building and the process in which he'd right with Burt Bacharach.
So thanks very much.
See you next week.
But we used to sit in the room in the Brill Building, which I guess it was the Tin Pan Alley of our time. And we had a small office at famous Paramount, which is the arm of Paramount Music. You're publishing a Paramount film, and we had a room that was very narrow. There was an upright piano that Bert sat at, and right next to us to the right was a desk with a chair, and then to walk from the door to my desk and past the chair of the piano, two people couldn't get through. You could only be one at a time. There was an air conditioner in the window, so you couldn't open the window. So we had air conditioning on, winter and summer. And we'd sit there, and we'd meet each day, and we'd start Bert would have some melody phrases written down, and he'd play them for me, and, I would like this one, and not so sure that one, and I'd have some titles or lines, and I'd show it to him, and he would like this one, and maybe not that one. And we'd find something that we both liked, and we'd start writing that song, whether it was from the melody side or the lyric side.
Oh, how can I forget you when there is always something there to remind me?
That was Hal David in conversation with Adam Sweeting in 1999, concluding this week's Rock's Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guests Lloyd Bradley and Tom Vickers. Lloyd's website is lloydbradley.net, where you can find details of his work, including his books Bass Culture and Sounds Like London. Tom's website is tomvickers.com, where you can find information about his work and about Tales from the Tour Bus. The hosts are Barney Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and the producer was Jasper Murison Bowie. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews, at rocksbackpages.com.